Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Susanna Constantine, and this is my wardrobe malfunction. Oh, it's Christmas Eve. I love Christmas Eve. I think I love it even more than Christmas Day, because it's when we give our presents to each other, and we always have goose, because that's what the Danes do, and then Father Christmas comes in the night and delivers his presents, which we open in the morning, all together in my and my husband's bed, all the kids and the dogs and the two cats, and it's heaven. This actually is a bonus episode and our 67th in total. And our guest today is a seasonal sizzler with the iconic burlesque star, Dieter von Teese. So let's grab the handles, open my wardrobe doors, and find out what's inside. Hello, everybody, and I am absolutely wetting myself with excitement about my guest today, because she has long been an icon of mine. So I'm really delighted for this Christmas special to be with the eternal queen of burlesque, Dieter von Teese. How are you?
Hello, I'm fine, thank you.
Genuinely, I can't believe we're speaking. I'm slightly gutted I can't see you, but there is a beautiful photograph of you on a what looks like a sort of crystal telephone.
Yeah, that's exactly what that is. And that's actually what I'm wearing right now. So, you know, I just, it's representative of my look
you
this morning, bright and early.
You are such a liar. You are such I a am. Filthy liar. We had a little chit-chat before. She is in her pajamas and her dressing gown.
But actually, you know what? I'm looking at what I'm wearing, which is the same color, ice blue fleece glamorous dressing gown by Catherine Delish. So okay. It is very similar, just without the rhinestones and feathers.
Okay, but that sounds good. That sounds good.
It's true. I expected you,
Dieter, to be in a kind of slinky negligee, kind of bordered with Belgian lace, but that's not the case.
No, it is the case. Actually, I'm underneath my fleece dressing gown. So Catherine Delish makes these extravagant dressing gowns that are kind of like, all, you know, they've become very famous on social media and they're dripping in feathers. But she also does these like 1940s balloon sleeve dressing gowns to the floor in like a light, like silky fleece. So that's what I'm wearing. And I have my silk marjolaine from Paris negligee underneath in turquoise with bronze lace trim. So it is true that I'm wearing something comfortable but still glamorous. That's the name of the game for me.
Always. And it sounds that dressing gown does sound stunning. And isn't Catherine, hasn't she worked with you for quite a long time?
Yes. Yeah. She and I have been creative partners on all of my burlesque shows since 2000 when we met. And so she, you know, basically started making these dressing gowns, which every drag queen and burlesque star and extravagant, fun woman in America and all over the world has and loves to be photographed on social media with it. So it's kind of a thing, and her, you know, second career after burlesque is these beautiful dressing gowns.
As soon as I finish speaking to you, I'm going to get online and order one. It sounds fabulous. It's going to be a Christmas present to myself.
It is. I love the fleece ones are amazing because it's like pure glamour, like sweeping glamour gown, but in fleece. It's incredible. I love
it. Perfect. And my love, you're based in LA, aren't you?
I am, yes.
And does it get cold enough for that kind of garb?
Oh yeah, well, California notoriously is cold at night and then in the morning and then suddenly it's summertime in the afternoon. So yeah, that's what we have here, which is nice.
Yep, that is so nice. So, so nice. And what will you be doing for Christmas?
Well, I'm meant to be hosting a few friends at my place. I'm thinking about making like a very British fish pie for dinner. So that's what I'm doing. Just a few friends. I'm trying to figure out how to make it, keep it low key, because I have my New Year's Eve burlesque show at one of the big old theaters out here in LA. And so there's a lot of work to be done, but I still love entertaining. So I'm trying to figure out how I can do both things.
Fantastic. Yes. Cause you've got the New Year's show at the, is it the Orpheum Theater? On New Year's.
Yes, yeah. The Orpheum. Mm-hmm. It's on Broadway, one of those beautiful movie palaces, burlesque, it was a vaudeville house. It's incredible. So I take that over every year, although we skipped a year, of course. Mm-hmm. So we're back at it, and I'm very excited. I've hired an orchestra to be on stage with me this time. So I'm really kind of upping the ante with the extravagance of the show this year.
I mean, your shows are obviously known for exquisite taste, I would say. They're very, very classy. They're over the top, but not gaudy. And I mean, how do you come up with ideas? How do you sort of keep evolving the show?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I have, between Catherine and I, we have no limits to the ideas we have. It's usually just the limit on finances, and how many projects I can do and what makes financial sense, because, you know, it is extravagant. You know, some of the costumes take months to make and require a truckload of Swarovski crystals. We love doing things in an extravagant way. It's what's always driven us, is to push the envelope. And she certainly has with regard to costuming. You know, she's influenced so many people, you know, in the things that she's been doing for the last 25 years. So she's created incredible innovations, and she's always like, listen, I don't care if everybody's copied what I do and is taking credit for it. I'm on to the next thing. You know, we don't sit around thinking, oh, everyone copied what we did. It's like, oh, we have an endless, we do. We have so many things we want to do beyond what we've done. So, but I love, like, you know, for me, I like burlesque that's playful and fun and sometimes a bit kitschy. Like, for instance, I was in this year, I just got back from Paris. I was doing Dancing with the Stars, and all I could think about was, oh, this is going to be like ballroom dance striptease. Duh. Yeah. Like, you know, that's what I'm doing now. It's like, I'm going to do this whole act, but I'm going to use striptease. And then one year I was learning a few magic tricks, some illusions, and I thought, well, striptease and magic, it makes sense. You know, and this is, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, but I feel like I always want to bring together something like that and turn it into a striptease. And that's kind of what I've always been doing, is like taking inspiration from other worlds. And originally for me, it was 1940s movies, and how do I turn, you know, a 1940s Technicolor musical scene into a striptease? So I don't know. For me, it's fun, and I love challenging burlesque and evolving it. That's the only way to make it continue on, and that's why it is popular still, is that it's a huge evolution since what it was in the 40s when it was entertainment for heterosexual men. You know, it's gone so far beyond that, which I'm very grateful for that, you know, that I have a different kind of... I have a different audience, a very different audience than I would have in the 40s.
Mm. But I love the idea of what you say about using striptease as the and burlesque as the foundation, and then marrying it up with something like magic. It's. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, you know, in saying that, it's clearly a limitless partnership with whatever you want, you know, from ice truckers to... God knows what. I mean, you could go completely mad. Yeah. I guess you've...
It's like I took all my ballet training and I was like, I'm going to do... I was a failed ballet dancer, so I'm going to turn a ballet scene into a striptease. It's just like there's so many funny things to do like that make it, you know, not just a striptease and not about, like, you know, always about sensuality, but turning it into something kind of funny, you know, and that's, you know, that's what does it for me.
And how do you bring humor into it?
I mean, it's not hard. It's like, I think about things like, I mean, listen, bathing in a giant champagne glass, it's kind of funny, you know? That's one of the first acts that we did, was like, let's do, Catherine and I did a dueling striptease with the swinging hip martini against the classic elegant champagne, and we kind of did this thing with the two personalities, and you know, that's kind of where it started, and with us together. And, you know, we just think of like what would be, you know, a little bit clever. It doesn't have to be, you know, we don't want to go too far over people's heads, if you know what I mean. It is still burlesque. It's, and to, and the word burlesque itself, it was, it means to make fun of. So, you know, I'm always kind of making fun of myself and cliches and, you know, like, things that are, I don't know, for me, it's just, I always just think of like funny things. Like, what if I ride a giant bucking and spinning lipstick? You know, so I bought a mechanical bull and I took the mechanical bull parts off and created a giant lipstick and I rode the lipstick. You know, to me, it's amusing. And it counterbalances the eroticism. You know, I made it like a fetish themed thing, but it makes it funny and amusing. I never want to do anything that's too serious. It's not what I set out to do. I set out to change people's minds about burlesque and striptease and use that humor and playful side, because if you get down to it, you know, that's kind of one of the sexiest things, is our sense of humor and the way we feel comfortable around others and let loose. You know, it's not really about like, look how sexy I am. It's like, that's not what it has ever been for me.
Because I read that when you, I mean, your real name is Heather Sweet, and you were born in Michigan. And I read how incredibly shy you used to be. And you're so right in saying that confidence, I believe too, that confidence is a very sexy thing. But how did you overcome your shyness to end up where you are today?
I mean, I think it's just little by little and controlling the circumstances I could. I mean, when I was, you know, 18 and 19 and first started, you know, hanging out with club kids and drag queens and playing with my look, that kind of counteracted my shyness, and I surrounded myself with other people that made me, you know, made me feel uplifted and I could be creative with, and that's where I started gaining my power. And I think like little by little, like there's been so many moments in my career where I felt like I had to challenge my shyness, and I always felt like performing was part of that. And you know, so it's just like little by little, like there was moments where I worked, you know, with the Mac AIDS Fund, and I suddenly had to give speeches all over the world, and I was terrified of public speaking, but I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to teach myself how to do this. And I'm going to show myself that if you fail or stumble, it actually makes people like you better anyway. So I would do that. Like I would give these speeches in front of hundreds of people, and I'd be terrified, and I'd, you know, kind of look at it like, here's a moment to overcome or to, you know, embrace where you stumble, and people love it. You know, I would do something like, listen, you guys, every time I make a fumble this speech, I'm going to take something off. And so I would like drop a strap, and people would laugh, and they'd love it, and they'd say, that's such a charming way to, like, you know, and I never really took anything off, but I would take like my glove off and say, now I feel more comfortable. So I would think of ways to, and people would like it so much better than me going up there and giving like a perfect speech, you know. So always kind of like challenging, doing things that make me feel a little uncomfortable, but vulnerability is a big strength in show business too, especially, yes. You know. So.
Yes, I think it's, well, it shows humility. And I think as much as anything, and it's hate this word, but authentic. It's so overused, but it is. It's you. But I mean, I cannot tell you how much I love the idea of taking something off every time you stumble.
Yeah, I mean, it was like I'd say that, and I'd take off an earring or something. It's not like I did a striptease to try to give this important speech about the work the AIDS Fund was doing. It was just more like, oh, an earring. And people would go, oh, yeah, an earring, okay. You know, so just thinking of things like that.
Yeah. And my lovely, you're one of three sisters, is that right?
Right, yes.
And you describe yourself, I want to ask you, have you looked at yourself in the mirror ever? Because you describe yourself as the plain middle sister of three.
Yeah. Well, I mean, listen, it's just the reality of it, honestly. And people always say, but no, but listen, I go out on every Halloween, not every Halloween, but when I'm up for it. I love to take off the red lipstick and the red nail polish, wear my hair. I usually get like a really good blondish, brownish, some kind of wig, straight hair, and I put on jeans and a t-shirt. And I just like lose all of my privileges. I lose like people aren't interested in talking to me anymore, and I kind of blend. And that's what I'm when I'm saying that, it's like, okay, I'm not like saying like, I just don't. I found myself through glamour and my confidence, and like found a way to make my own mark on the world. And that's what I did by, looking to the past and wearing red lipstick and doing, essentially what makes me feel confident. When I do that Halloween thing that I do with the normal girl costume, I do it because it's a funny thing where it's a psychological moment where I realize why I do what I do and why I'm not going to let anyone tell me that, my cat eye or my red lipstick ages me. Like, 'cause people say things like that all the time, like, "Oh my God, you look so much younger without all of your makeup on." But why are we always holding such importance on looking younger? Like, I always just liked feeling like a woman. I like glamour. I like a sense of whimsicality in my appearance. And I don't really care if I just look younger. So I don't know. It's kind of just something that all goes back to confidence, and where I find my confidence is in that. And certainly I've done photo shoots where I've been stripped down and told not worn makeup. I've been photographed like by major photographers that said, "Can we do one with beige lipstick?" And I was like, I guess so. But I always kind of negotiate, can we do something that's me at the end? Because I'm being photographed by one of the world's greatest photographers. Like, can I have a moment? Can we negotiate?" But it's just really, I don't know, that's what I preach really is like, I call myself a glamour evangelist because for me, it's helped me find myself. And for a lot of other women that have been given permission as well to like indulge in beauty and glamour and eroticism, even in their own sensuality, I feel like when I was growing up, I didn't really have many examples of that, which is why I looked to the past. And it's not for everyone. It's just that's how it makes me feel, and a lot of my fans too.
So would you say, Dita, that yes, it evolved, but is it sounds from what you're saying is that the Dita Fontes that we know and the public know is more you, much more you every day when you're sleeping, when you're eating, than the girl with the wig and jeans.
Right. It just, for me, I found what I always say to people is when it comes to confidence, it wavers. It's like the weather. Sometimes I feel really good and sometimes I don't. And I try to notice what are the things that help me find my confidence, And I try to control those circumstances as much as possible. And that could be, that's different for everyone. What those things are different for everyone. So I think that's really what I'm always trying to get across and trying to keep in mind for myself as well.
Because I feel, I don't know how you feel about this, but I really do feel when I look at fashion now, I mean, I have a very how shall I say it? I'm not big, but I'm bountiful. So I've got big boobs, I've got quite a small waist. But I find clothes now in fashion is just so androgynous. And I find it so hard to find things to wear that make me that don't make me look like sort of matronly or like a dowager duchess. And the answer is probably corsets, to really accent if you've got a kind of curvaceous figure is to accentuate it. But at my age, I'm 10 years older than you. I just feel like I'm past it to do something like that, and I'm going to end up looking like a pantomime dame.
Yeah. But listen, I'm not wearing a corset in real life. Like that's my stage. That's for photos and stage. Like I'm not sitting here cinching up. No, I'm not doing that. That's not how it is for me. I love finding ways of looking the way that I like to look without it being too high maintenance. You know, I'm not as high maintenance as it seems. I color my own hair. Mm-hmm. I do. I'm a very do-it-yourself girl. That's what I wrote a book about, is like glamour, do-it-yourself. On a normal day, like today, for instance, I'm doing two podcasts. I'm going to my dance rehearsal. I have a fitting with a lingerie model. I'll put on my red lipstick and I'll put my hair in a chignon, and that's what I do. And I'll have, you know, my rehearsal clothes with a skirt over it. Mm-hmm. But it's like, I think sometimes people just can't see, like, it takes just as long for me to put on a red lipstick as it does for someone else to do their day-to-day face. I think that people just think that I'm spending the whole day in front of the mirror getting glamorous, but that's not it at all. Like, my whole, I guess it's hard to imagine if you don't know me very well or know that well what I do, but I don't have time for that. I'm running, like, you know, a bunch of business. I'm doing business and I wake up and I'm ready to go. But I have my system the same way I think anyone else has their quick thing that they do. But I won't sacrifice, you know, I say, I'm going to put on my red lipstick because that makes me feel good. And I have my, you know, I have my lashes on because I, you know, there's this great company called Lashify that I discovered during the pandemic, where I can be my own lash technician and have lash extensions that I can wear for 3 or 4 days at a time. So I'm like, I love the shortcut. So I go, okay, I got my lashes and my red lips on and a little bit of concealer and I'm good to go. You know, so this is, I love to find fast ways of doing it, but I don't want to compromise because I want to keep my confidence. I want to feel good when I leave and I want to feel like I have my little pop of color in my red or fuchsia lipstick. It's just what I love in life and have since I was a teenager.
Of course, yeah. I mean, I feel weirdly exactly the same way about cooking, because I will produce, I love to cook. Well, most of the time I love to cook, but I've worked out that I'll produce something which looks and tastes amazing, but I've done it so quickly and being able to multitask doing other things at the same time. And I guess it's the same thing. It's just finding a way that works for you, and it almost sort of becomes automatic in what you're doing. You know, it's what you feel comfortable in and how you go out. And
I'm the same way with cooking. Like, my simple recipes, like, it's kind of, it is beauty in cooking, or your look. You know, you have a uniform, but you've found a way, you've thought out a way to make something delicious without it being too fussy. And I'm the same way. I'm always looking for those 5-ingredient fabulous recipes, things that are really simple. But that's what I do with glamour too, is like, okay, these are my ways that I get to it quickly because it's important to me.
Yeah. So your family moved to California when you where you attended high school. And was this when you went to work in a lingerie store and your interest in lingerie was truly born?
Yes. I think, you know, I don't know why really, but when I was really like younger and living in Michigan, I used to always sneak into my mother's lingerie drawer. Mm-hmm. I was so fascinated by what was in there and why is she wearing this stuff and I'm not wearing this stuff. And, you know, I was just always fascinated with this kind of rite of passage and when it was going to be my turn. And so anyway, of course I had those kinds of rites of passage when I was, you know, 14 or whatever. And my mom worked in beauty. She was a manicurist, and just next door to where she worked, there was a lingerie shop. And I used to go in there all the time. And I kept asking if I could work there, you know, like taking out the trash or putting tags on things. And finally, the woman that owned it let me do that, like check in boxes of lingerie and put the tags on. And then eventually I got to work as a sales girl. And that was when I was like 15. And I worked in lingerie, whether it was in this little store or in a department store, till I was maybe 22. And that's really what sparked my entire career as a pinup girl. I basically thought, like, well, maybe I should be photographed in my lingerie, but I want to do it like a 1950s pinup girl. So that was kind of what sparked my career for doing that. And I just always had this fascination with lingerie. And it's really, you know, why I do what I do. Because then it was suddenly like, okay, what if I do a burlesque show? It's again about wearing corsets and stockings and, you know, gloves and all these kind of being totally dressed. But performing that way. So then, you know, and this is in the early 90s when I decided to do these things, and nobody was doing burlesque at the time. There were very few people performing burlesque. And so that was, you know, I was like, I'm going to do this thing that Gypsy Rose Lee did. I'm going to do this thing that Betty Page did. And I'm going to be the first one to be a pinup girl all the time. And that's what I did.
And was that like a light bulb moment for you? Or did it kind of creep up? Was it like, I know exactly what I'm going to do now?
Yeah, it kind of creeped up. In fact, you know, I was working in the LA underground rave scene, and I was always dressing in vintage and making little like sequined bustiers and things like that. And I guess it was sort of little by little. I mean, when I was, I started working in a strip club, mm-hmm. Moonlighting from my lingerie job. And I, you know, another way to show off my lingerie, it was kind of like a bikini club, you know, where okay. girls were all wearing bikinis, but I was wearing like corsets and lingerie, and I thought it was so much fun to do this, and I wasn't even showing anything really. So, and then that's sort of like, I was doing this striptease thing, but I didn't, and then I kind of connected that to burlesque, you know, if that makes sense. It was sort of like I was doing the striptease thing, and then I went, wait, oh, it was called burlesque in the 1940s. So, oh, I should get myself a pair of feather fans. Where can I get that? So it was a little bit little by little, and it was kind of like I was doing it before I put a name to it. And I don't think I ever really took it seriously until, you know, the late 90s when I was, you know, I was a very well-known fetish model. I was the modern Betty Page. I was being flown all over the world to London to pose for fetish magazines and companies in Germany. And, you know, so I was kind of like I was the modern Betty Page in the early 90s. And I was, you know, doing burlesque shows in back then too, to kind of like promote what I was doing as a model. So it kind of started there, and it evolved and got bigger and bigger till suddenly I was like, oh wow, I've got a book deal with HarperCollins. I'm performing at the Cartier event. I'm performing for Louis Vuitton in the Grand Palais in Paris, and the Crazy Horse. And I kept doing it though. It was sort of, it took me a long time to come to terms with it being a real career.
Gosh, but I must have, you know, I'm going back to the shy girl, but because your confidence was given time to grow, mm-hmm. and you didn't, you know, it
for
just,
sure.
It seems like you didn't push yourself completely. You just let it happen. And do you think that's the secret to longevity? Is because you, rather than, you know, so many people in the public now, they gain their fame overnight and then they crash and burn.
Yeah.
Do you feel that those who do have the longevity are the people who have taken a long time to learn their craft or get used to it? Or do you think that's the case?
I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, somebody asked me the other day, they said, what are your big goals that you have? And I said, you know, I don't know. I've never actually dared have lofty goals. I was sort of, my reward was always in what I was doing at the present. And I was trying to do it with integrity and joy, you know, whether it was, you know, listen, I was touring strip clubs across the US in the 90s. And I thought that was the height of my career, was like having a billboard near a truck stop in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin.
Yes.
You know, it's like, I thought that was the thing, you know, I had a page in the newspaper, you know, the pinnacle of my career, and I had gratitude for it.
Yeah.
I think the problem is a lot of people, they just see, especially with burlesque, because also I was doing burlesque at a time where there was no modern burlesque stars, you know, so I didn't have anyone to look at except for Gypsy Rose Lee, and that hadn't happened in 75 years. So I couldn't see that I could be famous for it. I think part of the problem is now is like people see the fame or the end result and they go, I want to get there. And they don't think about the doing or whether they love what they're doing. They just like, I think I should do that because that will bring me accolades or money or fame and people will like me. And they don't really think about, you know, I did something that was not like very cool at first, you know, it was like, oh, she's a stripper. Oh, she's a stripper. And I was so like, yeah, I'm a stripper. It's super fun. I'm loving this, you know. Fan dancing at a truck stop was fun, but I was like loving what I was doing, you know?
Did you do that?
I did. Yes, I did. It was like, there, you know, there's, I was doing a strip club circuit all over America. And, you know, I was like headlining. I was like the headlining star
because
I was
in
Playboy.
Store.
Yeah, but like it was a truck stop with a big night, you know, a big strip club in it. And I was like, this is great. I'm the star stripper at the truck stop.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It was, I got some great vintage clothes. I think it was in Pittsburgh. And so during the day, I'd go, this is when I amassed a crazy vintage clothing collection, was I would, you know, be in places like Pittsburgh, and then I'd go to all the vintage and antique stores and snap up all those 40s dresses and jewelry.
Amazing.
So I loved it. I was having so much fun. But, you know, I didn't have someone to look at and be like, oh, I should really be doing what she's doing. Mm. I was just doing my thing. And it was I think to me, that was one of my strengths, was that I wasn't like looking at somebody else's career, modeling it after them. I mean, maybe I was looking at Gypsy Rose Lee's career thinking, okay, well, maybe I can be like that and I can do pinups and I can do shows and tour, you know, because Gypsy Rose Lee also, you know, yes, she was dressed in Charles James, but, and had the Rockefeller apartment in New York and you know, she was a great businesswoman, but she also would go on the carnival club circuit, which was not glamorous at all. Okay. Like the reality of her burlesque career was she would go do that for like, you know, a couple months and make a ton of money because she didn't spend money on lavish costumes or props or anything like that, really. Make a ton of money and then invest it and go buy her, you know, apartments and houses in Beverly Hills. Like she was so smart, so much smarter than me when it came to money. You know, well, listen, I love costumes. I love feathers and rhinestones, but she wasn't that. She was like very, you know, she went and did the carnival club circuit was rough.
Yeah.
There was burlesque and vaudeville, but like, you know, she was smart. She made her way and did all these like crazy, you know, doing a burlesque show in a tent.
Yeah, that must have taken huge strength as a woman at that time.
Yeah, a single woman with a little boy too.
Yeah. I remember my dad actually loved Gypsy Rose Lee so much. He used to call my mum Gypsy Rose. Her real name was Mary Rose, but he used to call her Gypsy Rose, kind of wishful thinking, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, he was obsessed by her. But so was your family quite sort of straight-laced, or I guess it sounds not. It sounds like your mum was very kind of open to beauty and lingerie and everything else. I mean, what did they think when you started your career from a shy girl to a stripper?
Well, listen, I kind of got caught in the, you know, my parents were getting a divorce and, you know, having affairs with their, you know, significant others who are still their significant others now. But like, I kind of got caught in the nobody cared what I was doing.
Okay, yeah.
You know, I was always independent. I was working. I had my own credit cards by the time I was 16. And I feel like I was super independent. And so every once in a while, they'd turn to me and be, you know, I was living on my own by the time I was 20. And even when I was a teenager, it was like, they didn't even have time for me. You know, I didn't have support, but they also, you know, when they'd turn to me and be like, what are you doing? I'd be like, oh, just you mind your own business. I'm 18 years old. You know, I was very like, what are you doing? Did you put me through college? No, nobody ever even talked about college in my family.
Yeah.
So I was always independent. Like I said, I was working from when I was 14 years old because I realized early on that independence was, you know, financial independence was kind of the key, you know?
Freedom.
Yeah, freedom. And so, you know, in the 90s when I was, you know, in my early 20s and deciding I was going to be this bondage model, answer to Betty Page. Yeah, my family sometimes looked at me like, what are you doing? We're really worried about you. And I was just like, yeah, listen, I'm fine. And then, of course, when I became famous for it, when I was on the cover of Playboy, when it was a big thing, that was kind of a turning point for me, was I was on the cover of Playboy. I was, you know, performing for, you know, Marc Jacobs and Louis Vuitton and all these people. That was like a moment where they finally went, oh, we get it now. So I didn't have a lot of support, of course. Okay, like, I don't want anyone to think I had like all this amazing support from my family when I was doing these bondage pictures in the early 90s. It was more of like, what are you going to tell me to do? Why are you able to tell me that I'm doing something wrong? You know, so that's a little bit who I am, you know. It's just like,
you know, I think it's very interesting that, because I think women who were kind of born in sort of 60s, 70s, it's like there was no expectation on our shoulders. It's like, you know, I know for one, my parents, they expected me to amount to nothing. It was like, darling, don't worry. You'll just go and find a good husband.
Yeah. Same thing.
And that
here.
Was it. I was discouraged from going to university. My father said to me, oh, darling, you really don't need to go to university. I was like, what the fuck? Mm-hmm. And I look back now and I think, and I compare that to my own children and how, thankfully, how much drive they have and, you know, sort of academic drive as well as personal drive. I didn't even have my own opinion at their age.
Right.
Because I wasn't encouraged to do that. So I think for anyone, and especially for you, to have gone out and done what you've done where no one could mold you because there was no mold to fit in apart from Gypsy Rose Lee, really, is... That actually, for me, is the most astonishing thing. I mean, it's amazing, Dita.
Thank you. I mean, it's just a little happy accident. And sometimes people ask me, you know, like, how did you do it? I'm like, I don't know. It was just sort of like I did it because I liked it. And I didn't listen to what other people told me about what I should be doing. You know, like I had people that told me if I wanted to be a model, I should go back to my natural blonde hair and I should get a little bit of a tan and all these things. And I just thought, why do I want to be doing what everyone else is doing? And I still feel that way even about burlesque. It's like people all want to be there's people that want to be a burlesque star, but they can only see what I'm doing or whatever these other people are doing. And it's like the key is to do something different and change people's minds about what that is. And are you going to be the person to flip the script? You know, that's the thing. But sometimes people don't see beyond what the success of others, I think.
And what goes behind it. Because I imagine you must do a huge amount of research into the costume and the way things were made and how they can be adapted.
I have to say, another key of what I did and Catherine did was, you know, we didn't have any, you know, people just now they do their research on the internet, you know, Google images, Google, you know, YouTube videos, like I'm going to dance like this. We had to make it up for ourselves, you know. I hate being that person that says, like, in my day, but like really, in our day, we were looking at and reading burlesque books or looking, hunting down little moments in like vintage, you know, classic films and taking inspiration from that, but like, or just deciding what we thought burlesque might look like. And then actually, once I saw real burlesque footage, I was like, oh, I didn't know it was like that. Well, I'm glad I didn't see that because actually I like what I'm doing better, you know, like, because it was really this like bump and grind kind of like thing. And, you know, by the time I saw it, I was like, I'm glad I used my ballet training to kind of do a striptease instead of the classic bump and grind. I mean, and I'm not knocking it. It just wasn't for me. And it's part of what made me find my own way instead of mimicking what I saw.
Well, I mean, what you've created is something which is quite ironic in a way. Yes, you're doing a striptease, but the clothing plays such a huge role. It's an essential part of burlesque.
Yes.
It's not the no clothes, it's the clothes.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, I wear a lot of clothes. And when people say, like, well, why do you even need clothes? Well, where are you going to start? It's not interesting, like, just coming out on stage with no clothes on. That's not a striptease. So that's where the costumes become so extravagant. I mean, there's like, you know, 15, 20 pieces of each costume. And when every piece comes off, it becomes a new, it's a new look, you know, it's a different style. It's a new, like, that's what we do is make this, how do we wear as much as possible? So there's a ways to go that becomes like a, you know, it's a, I hate that I'm going to say this word. It's like a onstage journey, you know, like you get to see, you know, it's like an evolution of the costume. I know, I hate using that word. An authentic striptease journey. I know, it's funny. I want to roll my own eyes when I hear myself talk like that. Oh, because, you know.
But I can see that. It's almost, those costumes, it's almost engineering what you're doing.
It's major engineering, and it's like the biggest extravagance I have, because it's like to make, I'm not interested in doing it the easy way. I love doing it the hard way. I love the challenges that come with a new costume and pushing the envelope and thinking, okay, how do we make this as hard as seemingly impossible to get off as I can, you know, like, cause I kept thinking about magicians, and, you know, magicians do all these things. Like, how do we make it complicated so that nobody else can do it? First of all, it becomes this trade secret. And so I would do things like that. Like, okay, I'm going to have this corset that laces from the top of my back, and there's no way out except for to unlace that behind my back all the way down to the butt. And I'm not going to put a closure in the front so I can figure out how to get. So I love thinking of things like that. Like that are make it more difficult, and like I've gotten stuck, and there's somebody standing by with scissors on the side. But like eventually, the impossible becomes totally possible, and that's what I love. And you know that something becomes, you know, you can learn how to do it with enough practice. And I know it sounds stupid to even talk about like striptease as something that's a Houdini trick, but you know what? It is.
I so get it. What's the most elaborate costume you've worn? Or maybe it hasn't appeared yet.
Hey, I'm waiting on two costumes right now. Jenny Packham is making a costume for my New Year's Eve show. Jenny Packham's like a really amazing British designer. And, you know, that's going to arrive, you know, the 27th, and I'll have that week to work it out before the show. But it's a costume that goes through ballroom dance cliches from a foxtrot quick step ballroom dance gown. And then that transforms into a tango dress and then finally into a cha-cha short dress.
Gosh.
So it's kind of like a transition costume. So I'm really excited about that. But, you know, I'll get it and I'll spend a lot of time with it. And, but, you know, listen, it's fun. It's what, you know, flicks my switch. It's really like fun to do that and to think about like a new idea and a new concept and a new costume and working in collaboration with designers that I love.
Basically, you are a walking, performing Rubik's Cube is what you are.
Yeah, basically something like that. Sometimes I'm a walking chandelier. We have some of the costumes Catherine has made has these gigantic Swarovski crystals. Actually, I'm looking at a big tray of huge crystals that are, you know, the size of my palm. And we love that, though. It's so much fun to make it look easy, like make the gown look like it's slithering across the floor, but it's actually like, you know, 23 kilos of Swarovski crystal. And then when people see it in person, they say, how did you just do that? We did it because it was fun. And it made you think that it was weightless, but it's not.
Yeah.
So I don't know. We love that. We love when people say, why was that costume electrified? Was it plugged in? We're trying to understand what it was doing. No, it's like a special effects stone from Swarovski with extra facets, and it looks dazzling. It looks electrified. So I love that. I love that part of it. And, you know, while I was thinking about this, I thought, you know, Catherine and I, when we're making a show or a costume, we never think about what would the people want? We think about what does it for us. And,
yeah,
you know, because, and I think it's the same. It goes back to what we were saying about when you wear what you like, it's like that radiates to the world and then they will understand, you know? So if you feel it, the world will feel it. Or if they don't, fuck them, you know. but you know, I just feel like it's so important. It's not about what other people think or indulging in what other people tell you to do. It's like whether you're getting dressed to go to your job or putting your makeup on to go to your job. It's like it should be about what you feel, because that comes across to people. And the most important thing is, you know, what radiates to the world and what you put out there that you believe in.
And you've never had a stylist, have you? And you always do your own makeup, which is fabulous too.
Not always. I mean, I don't sometimes. And actually, I've learned to delegate because, you know, I find myself a lot of times in the last year, especially, I'll produce my lingerie shoots for my lingerie brand. They're based in Australia, but, you know, I'll organize everything. And I'd even say like, okay, to keep our team small so we can shoot in this fabulous place that my friend has, I'll do the hair, makeup, styling, blah, blah, blah. And I'll do it all. And then now I've gotten to the point where I'm like, okay, I'm exhausting myself and I need to actually, you know, so what I'll do is sometimes I'll do my makeup while somebody does my hair, or I'll, you know, or the other way around, I'll do my hair and let somebody else do the makeup. I'll bring in a stylist that I'll say, okay, can you pull all the, you know, jewelry from my closet and style the shoot for me and dress the other girls? It's just, yeah, it becomes a little bit too much. Yeah. Like, it is great to do it yourself. And like I always say, I do it myself so I can appreciate the value sometimes in other people doing it. But I still love being grounded in what I originally set out to do, is prove to people you can do it as well and enable people to say, okay, and girls who want to do, or anyone who wants to do a photo shoot, pinup style, it's like, you can do it. You can totally do it, you know, and we're seeing it everywhere. People do their own hair, makeup, styling, make their own costumes, and to even take their own picture. It's like you can
do it all. Yeah,
do it. And but you know, there comes a point where you have, you know, where I say to myself, okay, I did all of that. Now today, someone's got to do my hair for me because I need to answer these 45 messages that are on my phone this morning too, at the same time. So delegating,
practical decision more than anything else. Yeah, mm-hmm. Which I understand.
Yeah, but when I'm on tour, it's like I'm doing my own hair and makeup because I like the ritual of painting. I feel like I still, for the most part, I like how I do my makeup. I feel like me. It's nice when other people do my makeup. Sometimes it's better than what I do, and sometimes it's not. So I also only work with a few people that I know that can do what I like in a short amount of time, because I've sat in the hair and makeup chair for hours before and turned around and been like, now I've got to go fix this. So, yeah.
And how important are shoes to you, Dita?
Yes, I love shoes. However, you know, people, you know, I have a kind of infamous shoe closet because Christian Louboutin is one of my closest friends. And people walk in, they go, how many shoes do you have? And I say, I don't know. I don't count my shoes. I don't really care. I don't really care about how much I have. I'm not going shoe shopping. I'm just, you know, I have a good friend who makes incredible shoes. So, yeah, they're important, but I'm also understanding the value of having shoes that fit well. I never knew that when I was younger. I was sort of like, oh, that's fine. They look great. I'm going to wear these shoes that are a half size too small. And I've learned not to do that. I don't always wear high heels. I wear flats a lot. I've been living in some classic loafers the last few months while I was doing Dancing with the Stars and trying to save my feet.
Were you actually dancing yourself? Were you a competitor? I should know this. I'm sorry. I don't.
Yeah, I was a competitor. I was. Yeah, it was.
You must have won. You did. Must have won.
No, because, you know, that's not how the world works anymore.
Okay.
In fact, that's true. Yeah, that, you know, I always got the top three scores every week. But listen, it was in France, and they put the like social media votes and the text message votes, because that's a huge business. Like, okay, the YouTube star is going with 3 million followers only in France, and you have to use a French phone so they can get that 99 cents a minute, or that 1 euro a minute for per text. You know, I thought that I was going in there to win, because I was loving it, and I was working really hard, and I always got like the top scores. But listen, it doesn't work like that anymore.
No, it's so true.
So I went home.
I know from experience as well that I did strictly here. Trust me, I deserve to go out first. I look like sort of Ava Perón's corpse after she'd been embalmed. I was completely rigid throughout the whole thing. Oh my God, it's such hard work,
but it's so. I had so much fun though. I had so much fun. I was there for 3 months, and I had COVID at the beginning of the competition, so I only had 5 days to get ready, where everyone else had 2 weeks. And I had kept having these little victories, and it turned me into a fierce competitor, because I didn't think I could do well, because I always told myself I couldn't learn choreography. I had all these stories about my whole life I've been ducking out of my ballet classes when it gets too hard, and so I was afraid. And then suddenly I started having all these victories there on that show, and I was surprising myself at my ability, and I was really, I was excited. So then I was also deflated when I realized that they were, going to manipulate everything they could, to try to get me, send me home.
Yep.
Because I was kind of a nightmare for them.
You were too good.
Because I kept, I was very like about COVID protocols and such. Because I was like, why are there so many people backstage with no masks on and smoking cigarettes and drinking, and I have to get COVID tested 3 times? I was really giving them a hard time.
Good girl, I'm pleased to hear that. So, Dita, with all this traveling, is there something that you have that you would consider to be a comfort blanket?
I think for me, it's I love to have a beautiful coat, because I can be wearing just about anything underneath it. Mm-hmm. I'll get on a plane, I'll see people and they'll say, I saw you once on a plane and you looked so glamorous. And I thought, well, it's because I'm wearing a fabulous coat with a nightgown underneath, or a t-shirt underneath, something really comfortable, but the coat really glams it up and makes it look polished. So I'd always say a great coat is my comfort blanket, because I can throw it on for anything, to just I want to go out and get a coffee real quick, and I could put a coat on and sunglasses, and it's I look like I really did something there.
Fantastic. Now, you must have had a wardrobe malfunction, Dita.
Oh God! Well, I was thinking on Dancing with the Stars. I fought with the wardrobe, not the wardrobe people, but the production all the time. Just this is we were talking about that. For instance, before I left to go to Paris, I said, "Listen, I'm not going. I know that everyone knows me for striptease, but I'm not wearing any mini dress things or having my ass out." Mm-hmm. I have a lot of rules about what I wear when I'm performing, and this is not my show. This is your show. I can only control so much. And they were like, yeah, don't worry. And the fight ensued where they kept putting things in my dressing room that were not okay that I was not comfortable wearing. So, mm-hmm. Very interesting. Very interesting process.
But have you ever had a costume that's let you down? Something which you haven't been able to get out of, you mentioned the scissors earlier being snipped out of something.
Yes, I've definitely had many. In fact, when I was at the Crazy Horse, when I did create one of the most difficult costumes for me to get out of, I kept a scorecard between me and the corset every night. And I actually got one of those giant pairs of scissors they use for ribbon cuttings. And I had it engraved with striptease, in case of striptease emergency, use these. So I made light of it, but there's always been things like that. And really, it's about what you do with it. I've seen other burlesque performers who will remain nameless, but I've seen people get angry and storm off the stage because they couldn't get their outfit off. And, it's all about show business and live performance is all about how you handle things. And people will either like you if you make a mistake. Same thing of what I was saying about the speeches. They watch how you deal with it. It's all about how you, what is it, that quote about life is what happens to you, but more importantly, how you respond to it. Same thing with wardrobe malfunction. It's I've had lots of them. I was thinking about when I was going to dinner with a guy friend of mine and leaving the house. And as soon as I was walking down the stairs, my vintage dress split right down the middle. I mean, full ass out. And we had a great laugh though. And I went inside and changed, but I was like, thank goodness that happened before I got to the restaurant, and I've had, as someone who loves vintage, vintage is a big upkeep, and you will rip out seams and you will break the heels off of shoes, and all kinds of wardrobe malfunctions happen just with vintage clothes wearing in general. Mm-hmm. But I still love it. And also, I don't know. It's not what I can't really imagine myself running home and being like, oh my God, I can't believe my dress split up the ass. I'd sort of probably make a, I'd find a coat to put on or something, or something to tie around my waist. I don't know. And make a joke of it. Like, everybody's already seen my, you know, butt crack anyway. So here it is.
I mean, that's what I love about clothes, is that every item, and certainly for me, all, I have a whole kind of cellar filled with sort of clothes from when I was working in television. And you know, each piece has an amazing memory attached to it. And it might be that because something split and it's been hilarious, or it might be, you know, when I felt my best, or it might be when I got too drunk, or it might, you know, every piece has a memory. And that's what I love about it.
And that's why I'm a pack rat and I have two storage units full of my clothes. I just, I feel very attached to things. So I know what you mean.
And my lovely, has the Me Too movement, has that made burlesque and the burlesque in the world of stripping more challenging, do you think? Or is it just, do you just kind of keep on going and doing your thing?
I think because the show that I present, and even when I perform, I always have it counterbalanced with just as many men in the show as women. And also, you know, my show is always, since the beginning of my touring burlesque show, I've always embraced diversity, because I found that some of the best burlesque performers were not what you would think is the typical classic pinup girl burlesque queen from the olden days. I found that the best, most like fun to watch performers were people that were different. So I don't know. I think that maybe, yeah, listen, I felt a shift when, you know, when we had the crisis, you know, the credit crisis or whatever it was. That was, you know, when people stopped spending lots of money on shows and events and things. So I felt a shift then, but that was like in, you know, maybe, I don't know when, 2010 or something. I don't know. But I find, you know, because my, even when I do an event like now for a big brand or something, I'll say, listen, we should have my male, my guy backup dancers involved, because people love to see the balance and they don't want to anyone saying, oh, it's just a girly show. It's not a girly show. You know, I like seeing the men represented as well.
Absolutely.
So try to keep that balance, and which is what I've always done anyway. I just kind of am more adamant about it. Like, if we do this show, we're going to have these guys too.
And finally, what about a birthday suit? Not obviously that one when you're a little baby.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your favorite thing to wear?
Well, I have this dress from, it's kind of a famous dress from Jean-Paul Gaultier from the Haute Couture, and it's been part of museum exhibits, and I wore it for several photo shoots, and I wore it to a few events until he finally gave it to me. And I have that dress, and I pull that dress out, and it's like, really, you know, he gave it to me when we were in Dallas together, and I was wearing it for maybe like the third time, and we went to this like, we went to a couple like country roadhouse bars, and we went to one that was like a line dancing club in Dallas, and I was wearing this like dramatic long dress from the Haute Couture, and he was like, you know what I love is that you're wearing this dress and we're doing the two-step, this dress is for you. So that's one of my favorite things, is like, it's a long, beautiful hussar style gown. It's from when he did a collection that was kind of a Russian collection with all the military braiding down the front. It's beautiful. And it's my favorite dress that I have. So I pull that out every, you know, couple years and wear it, and
feel fantastic.
I like that Jean-Paul he's gifted me a few dresses like that, but the reason is always that I wear it in real life. It's not like going to be just living in archival tissue. It's like, let's pull that dress out and wear it again.
Well, I think that's where we love Jean-Paul Gaultier, and long may he, you know, his designs keeping us all happy. Dieter, thank you so much for your time, and I wish you loads of luck for your New Year's Eve show, and hopefully you'll come to London and I'll get to see you live.
Oh yes, I'll be at the London Palladium in March for 5 nights.
Okay, well, I'm definitely going to get some tickets and come and see you.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, and have a very happy Christmas.
Thank you. You too.
Dieter
thank you so much. It was wonderful speaking to you. If you happen to be in or near LA, you can buy tickets for Dieter's New Year's Eve Spectacular by going to dieter.net and find a link to all her other social channels in our episode notes. You can also find us at My Ward Mal on our socials or on our website at mywardmal.com. And of course, subscribe, rate and review us on your chosen podcast platform. God, that's a mouthful. Finally, you can find our sensational house band duo at duoguitarmusic.com or at Duo Guitar Music on their socials. That's it. Thank you so much again to Dieter, to Duo, and of course, thanks to you for listening. Merry Christmas and a happy and healthy new year to you all. Catch up soon. Until then, my wardrobe is officially closed.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.